This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ed Helms, got his start as a correspondent on The Daily Show. On the NBC series The Office, he plays Andy Bernard, a paper and printer salesman who isn't very good at selling or at keeping a girlfriend. Andy exudes an uncomfortable mix of arrogance and insecurity. Ed Helms was one of the stars of the hit film The Hangover, and now he stars in the new film comedy Cedar Rapids as a small-town insurance agent who's sent to a regional conference in what to him is a really big city, Cedar Rapids. At the conference, his naivete gets him into awkward situations involving alcohol, drugs, a married woman, and a prostitute, and he learns that the insurance company that prides itself on Christian values doesn't practice what it preaches. In the movie Cedar Rapids, as in The Hangover and the TV series The Office, Ed Helms gets to sing. He usually sings in a comic way. We asked if he'd be willing to sing for real, and he offered to bring his band, The Lonesome Trio. We enthusiastically took him up on the offer. Ed Helms, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome to the band. It's such a treat that you've brought your band with you, so thank you so much for that. Ed, can I ask you to introduce the band and the first song that you're going to play?
Of course, Terry. Ian Riggs is playing the bass. I'm playing banjo. Jacob Tylove is on mandolin. Together, we're the Lonesome Trio, and we're joined today by Chris Eldridge on guitar, who plays with the Punch Brothers. And we're going to play a great old standard bluegrass tune called Please Search Your Heart.
Search your heart, and maybe you'll find a reason to say I'm begging this time. I know I was wrong, but darling, I've paid. So please search your heart before it's too late. I said that I'd never be blue, and that I wouldn't cry if you found someone new. But this is my plea, give me one more try, and please search your heart, don't tell me.
Thank you so much. And that's Ed Helms and his band, the Lonesome Trio. So it's Ed Helms on guitar, Ian Riggs bass, Jacob Tylov mandolin with guest guitarist Chris Eldridge. Ed Helms, I never would have guessed that you loved bluegrass music from hearing you sing on The Office or in The Hangover. How did you fall in love with bluegrass?
Well, that is a mystery to me as well. I don't know where it started. I just know that, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and there was some early, I guess, exposure to it. But I also spent summers up in the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina. And it just was always a sound that resonated for me and felt like a connection to these places that meant a lot to me in the mountains of North Carolina. And I don't know, it just felt authentic and something that I gravitated to. I do think people who love banjo music are cursed in some way.
Because?
Well, because most people don't like it. And it's kind of an obnoxious instrument, but I just get a lot of joy out of it.
So, Ed, I really want to thank you for bringing your band with you. And I want to thank the members of the band who can't actually hear me because they're not wearing headphones.
but Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So I'm going to let the band leave, but Ed, I'm going to ask you to stick around, and I want to talk with you about your new film, Cedar Rapids. So in Cedar Rapids, you star as an insurance salesman in a small town, and you actually believe that insurance agents are really helpful people who help other people put their lives together after catastrophe strikes. You're truly dedicated to this, but you're also very naive, and you've never left the small town that you grew up in. And then you were asked to go to a regional conference in Cedar Rapids, and that's a really big city to your character. And when he gets to the hotel, he's just amazed. He's never stayed in a hotel. It's confusing and exotic to him. And in this scene, he's just checked in. He's walking to his room, talking to his girlfriend on his cell phone. His older girlfriend, played by Sigourney Weaver, who used to be his teacher in 12th grade. And so, is it 12th grade? No, it's when he was 12. He was younger.
Yeah, I think it was 7th grade or
seventh
something.
7th grade, 7th grade. So you're walking down the hall, talking on the cell phone, go into your room, and the hallway that you're walking through overlooks the hotel swimming pool. So I'm going to play that scene.
I just did the whole check-in rigmarole, and I'm on my way to my room.
Have you seen the pool yet?
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, there's like palm trees and stuff. The whole place smells like chlorine. It's like I'm in Barbados or somewhere.
Oh, here we are.
Mikasa, junior suite. Hang on a second here. Figure out how this deal works. He's like a stinking credit card.
It's Ed Helms in a scene from his new movie, Cedar Rapids. So, what did you tap into in yourself to play somebody so naive and so innocent as this character?
I think for me, it was kind of tapping into a little bit of idealism. And I don't know, I kind of really love this character, Tim Lippy, and want him to succeed. And I don't want him to learn the evils of the world. And so as an actor, it was just fun to tap into a really earnest and wide-eyed view of the world that, I don't know, that sort of celebrates optimism and hope in a way, but also a lot of fear.
Now, you get to sing a song in Cedar Rapids. You sing a song in The Hangover. You've sung a bunch of times on The Office. You usually try to have an opportunity to sing when you're in a TV show or a movie, and do you suggest that be written in, or, you know, is that usually done on your behalf?
Yeah, it's kind of at the point now where it just seems when I get involved with something, people are like, "How do we inject a song into this?" And I'm kind of trying to pull back a little bit, but I do love to sing. Music's a huge part of my life, and I also think that I've always felt like singing at the wrong time or the wrong volume or with the wrong energy can be one of the most hilarious things. So I always sort of use it for comedic effect. Although in Cedar Rapids, there's a little bit of a poignant turn on it, I guess. Although I still think there's some smiles going on. But it's something that I love to do and just pepper in here and there.
When you were young and first discovering music, did you sing in church? Did you go to church? Or Were you ever in kiddie talent shows on or off TV?
No, I was never in kiddie talent shows, but I was in a church choir from a very young age. I see these pictures in photo albums of me in this little white choir robe, and I barely remember those times, but there's no doubt that I was just sort of being immersed in music a lot. And my family went to a Presbyterian church in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was mostly conventional hymns and so forth, but I don't know. It planted a seed of some sort.
And at what point did you want to be in a band? And did you want to be in a rock band?
Well, what adolescent boy doesn't want to be in a rock band of some sort? I got my first guitar when I was about 12 or 13. And my brother, who's a few years older, was in high school. And, you know, some of his classmates were in bands that I would see at school functions and so forth. And I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. So, yeah, I was always trying to get that going. I didn't have a lot of luck in high school in bands for some reason.
What do you mean by that? You weren't in them, or the bands didn't do well? Or?
Well, I played with guys here and there. But here's something that might surprise you, Terry. I get staggering stage fright when I play music.
Really? That does surprise me.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I've done stand-up comedy for 15 years, and I can step in front of a 2,000 people in a college auditorium and just chat for an hour and a half. But if you put an instrument in my hand, a guitar or a banjo, and I desperately want to share it with people, but I do oftentimes I have some stage fright, and it makes the technical act of playing difficult. And that's something I've always struggled with, even at piano recitals when I was a kid. I would freeze up. I remember a talent show at my school in junior high, and I played Scott Joplin's The Entertainer. And I froze in the middle, and I could not pick it back up. And I just couldn't find my place, and I just sat there for a minute and then stood up and bowed and walked off.
That sounds traumatizing.
I don't know. Maybe it was.
Okay, but when you were in high school and you were playing in bands, I mean, especially like in high school, I think you're expected in a rock band to project a certain confidence. What did you wear when you were on stage? Because I'm thinking about how your characters dress in your movie Cedar Rapids, Andy on The Office. You know, there's such a kind of either business or like collegiate look your characters tend to have. In The Hangover, you're wearing your sweater tied across your shoulders. So how did you dress when you were in high school in rock bands?
Well, I went to a kind of preppy high school. So like a lot of people, I cringe when I see pictures of my adolescence. But, you know, I was talking earlier just about how I got into bluegrass music. And for some reason, I think it does have something to do with this search for something kind of pure and authentic. And high school, of course, is the opposite of authenticity. It's everyone trying to posture and impress each other and be cool. And that was certainly me. So at that time, I think my musical interest was sort of off the beaten path, searching for something a little more real with a little more integrity or something. And that's not to say that bluegrass music has any more authenticity than anything else, but it does have a roots quality. And I was listening to a lot of blues and bluegrass at the time. And it just felt good. It felt like something a little more tangible and real than when I'd show up at school the next day and try to act cool despite the fact that I was anxious and had a huge crush on that girl and couldn't talk to her.
You know, it's funny, so much of the awkwardness that you're describing and the posturing that you're describing about high school also describes your character Andy on The Office, because he's often posturing and trying to impress people and playing cool when he's not.
That's an interesting point. And I hadn't made a real clear connection in that way to my life, but I suppose it's fair to say that Andy would be me if I didn't learn more about myself and came and became a little more self-aware. Andy's sort of the high school version of me in adult form, perhaps. Although Well, there's some other differences. I never struggled with anger management, for example, but certainly the posturing and the insecurity, I like to think that's most of us in high school.
Hangover 2 is coming out over the summer. Do I have that right?
Hangover 2 comes out Memorial Day. Yeah.
Great. Okay. You know, I love hearing people sing, whether they sing well or not. If they love music, I love hearing them. And I passionately believe that you should be allowed to sing and enjoy singing even if you don't sing well. Nevertheless, there's something so annoying about watching somebody who thinks that they're a great singer when they're not, which is something I think another thing you've tried to pick up with on portraying Andy in The Office. There's times when he thinks he's like so good and he's not, and other times when he really is good. Do you know what I mean? But why is it that there's, because you referred to this earlier, why is it that there's something so kind of comical and also annoying when somebody is trying to be really impressive and cool with their singing when they're not?
You know, I guess in the case of Andy, he's pretty good. I think he's a pretty good singer, but he's not nearly as good as he thinks he is. And like a lot of a cappella singers, he gets a lot more pleasure out of performing than the audience does out of listening. And so I don't know. I find that I actually kind of envy Andy's brashness and boldness as a performer, and that he really has no inhibitions. And he does have a lot of confidence. It may not be well-founded, but it's there. And that's always fun to watch.
It's so much fun hearing you sing in the studio and in TV shows and in movies. On The Office, one of my favorite Office episodes is the one in which you're in a community theater production of Sweeney Todd. I mean, Sweeney Todd is, I think, like the best musical ever. And it's so great because you're singing a song from it in The Office and somebody comes up to you and says, "Did you write that?" And you really have to be like a god of music theater like Sondheim in order to have written anything from that show. But anyways, do you love Broadway songs?
Of course. I mean, I think anyone who says they don't like Broadway musicals is lying or trying to be too cool for school or something, because they're just unstoppably good songs. Of course, not all of it's great, and I don't respond to all of it. But Les Mis was a big one when I was in high school, and I've always just loved that. And Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat has some great catchy tunes. My sister just bought that for her son, and he's already learning all the words. He's 5 years old.
Got to get him while they're young. Would you like to do an excerpt of a Broadway song that you've always loved?
This from Les Mis. Do you hear the people singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drum, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes.
Oh, I'm marching.
Will you join? No, I'm kidding.
Oh, ever in a production of that?
No, but that was sort of my go-to song either at high school auditions or when I was at college parties.
So you're working with Steve Carell now on The Office, and this is his last season.
Thank God.
Yeah, I'd be glad to get rid of him. Do you have any idea yet how he leaves and also what happens next? Or, you know, I know you're not going to tell me, but I'm wondering if you know.
Oh, well, that's the first time I've heard that question that way. And I can tell you honestly, I don't know. I know that there are plans, and I've been told that there are a few different plans, and they're not exactly sure how it's going to execute. The narrative of the show is incredibly fluid, and it really kind of changes with whatever is successful in the previous handful of episodes. So we have 4 episodes with Will Ferrell coming up, which will be crazy and fantastic. And then Steve's departure, which will be utterly heartbreaking, but of course very exciting for the rest of us to see where the show leads.
Ed Helms, you've been great. It was great to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Ed Helms stars in the new film comedy Cedar Rapids. You can hear a second song that he performed with his band in our studio on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Ed Helms in the Sweeney Todd episode of The Office.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd.
Yes.
He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod. It's Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Did you write this?
No.
Who did?
Stephen Sondheim.
Who is he?
Swing your razor wide, Sweeney. Hold it to the sky.
Cast of Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. We open in a couple of weeks at the Loose Screw Playhouse here in Scranton, and today just doing a wee bit of viral marketing.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The miniskirt was one of the iconic fashions of the 60s. The hairdo that went with it was a short cut originated by Vidal Sassoon. When his style became popularized and caught on in salons around the UK and the US, short haircuts were nicknamed the Sassoon, even though they didn't necessarily have his flair and finesse. He not only popularized short hair, he popularized geometric and sometimes asymmetrical cuts. Vidal Sassoon did the hair of famous models and movie stars and created a chain of salons around the world, as well as a popular line of hair products. But when he was growing up, his family was so poor, his mother put him in a Jewish orphanage for several years. Vidal Sassoon has written an autobiography that will be published in April. A new documentary about him opens in New York this week. As you listen to our interview, you can see a slideshow of Sassoon haircuts on our website, freshair.npr.org. Vidal Sassoon, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the first famous haircut that you gave. I mean, really famous. And this was to the actress Nancy Kwan after she made her movie, The World of Susie Wong. She had really long, straight hair. Why did she come to you, and what did you do with her hair?
Well, she actually had almost 4 feet of hair. And being rather small, she was 5'2", actually, she almost sat on it. So you had to be very careful when you put your hands through her hair, otherwise you'd be feeling parts of her bottom. And that would not have done. But, you know, I never looked at beauty as beauty. I always looked at bone structure and the way the face was created. It's quite fascinating for me. And I thought, we can do almost anything with Nancy. And I started to cut the very back of the hair, and I said, great neckline, I'll go shorter. And I went short in the back and graduated into more length at the sides. And I suddenly realized we had a bob that could be international. And it caught on. It caught on to the extent that people were coming in asking for it all the time. Not only with us, with many hairdressers, it had to be not only layered from the back to the front, but when she shook her head, it had to fall back naturally.
Now, did you set it at all, or was it just in the cut that it fell that way?
Oh, we never set those kind of heads. Setting was going out at the time. Far out.
Thank goodness.
Into the country. It wasn't happening in the big cities.
So when Nancy Kwan had her 4 feet of hair cut off for your bob, was it terrifying to her? Was she afraid that she wouldn't like it and she'd never be able to grow that much hair back again? And that hair had been her signature.
She was the coolest I have ever seen anybody. She played chess with her manager while I was cutting. It was quite extraordinary. There they were playing chess. I was cutting yards of hair off, literally. And she didn't make a murmur. I fell in love with her at that moment.
So you ended up giving Mia Farrow a very famous haircut for her movie Rosemary's Baby. And it was the director of that film, Roman Polanski, who approached you. How did you end up cutting her hair before Rosemary's Baby?
It's an interesting story. He wanted my balcony in London. I said, what do you want it for? He said, I'm photographing Catherine Deneuve on the balcony. They're filming. Repulsion it was. And instead of staying for 2 days, as he promised, he stayed for a week. Well, our clients loved it. They were there on the ground floor. He's on the balcony. And he didn't mind the noise. It was all part of the excitement. He didn't need quiet. So we just all carried on with our work. And eventually he left. Well, about 6 months later, I guess Roman figured he owed me something. He called and said, would I come to Hollywood and cut Mia Farrow for Rosemary's Baby? I said, Roman, I cut it about 2 months ago. It's not that long. She's a client of mine. And he said, well, there'll be something to take off, won't there? I said, yeah, I guess you're right. Now, Mia, out of some fit of pique, I'm not sure what it was all about, but she was married to Mr. Sinatra at the time, had cut into her own hair. She came to the salon and said, what can you do for me? I said, take it very short. That's the only way. I can't pull the short hair long, but I can cut the long hair short. And we did it, and it suited her marvelously because she had a shaped face and bone structure that was just perfect.
Was this when she was still on Peyton Place?
I don't know if she was.
I'm just asking.
I truly don't.
I remember when she was on Peyton Place, she had really long hair, and then one season she came back, and the hair was suddenly really short, and everybody who watched the show was shocked.
We cut it very, very short. And it was fascinating for me. When I say very short, it was literally about a half an inch. And why I say it was fascinating for me, because we were known in the fashion circles. You know, I did the shows in Paris and Milan and what have you, and middle America probably hadn't heard of us, and they would have found Vidal Sassoon a tongue twister, you know, rather than Joe Smith. And suddenly, Mia's face was everywhere on television, having a haircut. She was on the obviously in the magazines, on the radio, talking. It was just extraordinary. So suddenly Middle America began to know who I was. So she did me an enormous favor.
So when you cut her hair for Roman Polanski, for Rosemary's Baby, you had already given her a short haircut, and then you gave her an even shorter one for that film?
Exactly.
Okay. And it was actually an event, the haircut, because I guess it was the studio set up like a boxing ring, and for you to cut her hair in, and invited reporters to watch. So it was like a sporting event, you cutting her hair.
The reporters were totally unruly. They climbed into the ring and were photographing from the chair where I was working. I couldn't move. And we had to clear a space, but they stayed in the ring. And it was film, you know, NBC, CBS in those days, and ABC. And then, of course, photographers and reporters. And she started off berating the photographers, why are you here photographing a haircut when the indigenous Americans, it was the Marlon Brando thing at the time and she was involved, the indigenous Americans are living so badly and we're treating them so badly. And this went on for about 10, 15 minutes. Nobody took any notice, fortuitously. I mean, it would have been quite something had the photographers rushed out to go to the reservation, but they didn't. And eventually she calmed down and got into the act and had some fun. She pretended to cut Roman Polanski's hair, and we just had a ball. It was one of those nice afternoons.
So this is the part of the interview in which I confessed that at the time that the Sassoon spread around the United States and spread into, like, neighborhood salons, back when they were called, in my neighborhood, beauty parlors, I had a Sassoon. I had the neighborhood version of the Sassoon sometime in the mid-60s. I liked it. It was very easy to take care of, and my hair was kind of unruly without it. Yeah.
Yes, I'm glad they did a great job.
So what did you think when the Sassoon spread to people like me who got their hair cut in the neighborhood, you know, in the neighborhood salon? And it wasn't the work of art that that you had done, but it was a very popular haircut, very, you know, easy to take care of, look good. How'd you feel about the neighborhood cuts?
We were totally flattered, you see. It was, you either create something and you keep it a secret and you die with it. What's the point? If you can benefit a craft, and in essence, from that benefiting of the craft, you're doing something for fashion worldwide, I think that's so much more important. It's something that you leave behind that you probably will be remembered for.
When you started cutting hair, what were the hairdos that were popular?
Oh, flips, lots of lacquer, which was very difficult. Updos, you know, the ladies at lunch, those updos. But, the cutting wasn't there, number one, as it should have been. It was early.
You mean it was mostly about setting and spraying?
It was setting and spraying, yes.
And the hairdos?
Look, some of them look very, very pretty, but I wasn't after pretty. I was after bones. Getting into that bone structure, making it work.
And the teased hair and the...
It was a joke, really. Teasing people's hair like that and... making it look very presentable for the day, but what do they do the next day, you know?
Oh, I remember when I was growing up, the women in my neighborhood would go to the salon on Saturday, and then they'd get their hair set, teased, sprayed, really sprayed. And, you know, and then every night that week, they'd sleep with a hairnet so that they wouldn't mess their hair, and they were just kind of like, poof it out a little bit with their fingers or with a bobby pin in the morning, and they wouldn't comb it or wash it or do anything till they went back to the salon the next Saturday.
How unhealthy.
I know. Were you familiar with that approach to hair? Did you?
I never used it. I mean, I just thought, no, it's got to be in the cut.
Right.
From 54 to 63... when I went into my own first salon, I just said, we're not doing any of that old stuff anymore. It's very pretty and nice, but...
You're being so kind.
Stick to our guns. Well, you know.
When you started doing hair professionally, you went to a vocal coach, a speech coach, because you grew up poor. you grew up in an orphanage part of the time. You had a Cockney accent. You wanted to lose it. So you went to a teacher who actually worked with theater actors.
Yes.
Why was your accent important enough to you to study for 3 years?
I couldn't get a job in the West End. They would say, go and learn the language. And by the way, the language is English. I mean, it was that kind of thing. And
what did you sound like before?
Bit like that then, darling. Hello. How are you, love? That's a bit cockney. Anyway, Georgia Brown, who played Nancy and Oliver, we grew up together. We were kind of kids, 13, 14. And she became terrific. She did it on Broadway as well as London. And she said, Vid, take some elocution lessons. It would be very good for you, especially if you're going to be speaking in the future. I said, sure. Who should I go to? She said, Iris Warren. I've already spoken to her. So I went to Iris Warren. She looked at me and said, I don't take hairdressers. I work with actors. But be at the Old Vic at 2 o'clock Thursday. So I get to the Old Vic, and I'm in the green room, and this mellifluous voice was coming over the soundtrack, you know, and I was going, wow, I know that voice. I couldn't quite place it. The voice went. I was called into Iris Warren, and she said, well, did you hear it? I said, yes. It was marvelous. She said, who was it? I said, I couldn't quite get it. She said, couldn't quite get it? That was Laurence Olivier. And then she said to me, on the podium, got on the podium, enunciate. There were some words there to read. I enunciated. And she said, God, it's bloody awful. But I think I might be able to do something with you. She was quite fascinating. There was so many moments where I thought I was being trained like an actor, and I was, although I never did want to be one, frankly. Had I had a second choice, it would have been architecture. But my 3 years with Iris Warren were wonderful as far as I was concerned.
You spent part of your childhood in an orphanage. Your father left the family when you were very young. Your mother was very poor. You and your younger brother and your mother moved into your aunt's house. But at some point, your mother felt that it was just an untenable situation, and she put you in a Jewish orphanage. Why did she need to do that, and how did she tell you that she was going to put you someplace else for a while?
Well, there were five kids sleeping on mattresses in one room, and my mother and my aunt sharing another room. That was it, two rooms. And it did become untenable. And my mother approached the Jewish authorities, and they took me into the orphanage, and then my brother, 18 months later, because he was rather too young at that time.
How long were you in the orphanage?
I was in the orphanage for close to 7 years.
What did your mother tell you when she put you there?
She said that I'd be at a school where I could learn so much more than if I was in an average school. But it was a sleep-in school. I'd have to stay there. And
how accurate a description was that?
Very accurate, but it didn't please me one bit.
So was it more of a school or more of an orphanage?
It was an orphanage.
Right.
But you were sent to school. It actually was, you didn't actually have school at the orphanage, you were sent to school.
Did you get to see your mother during those years?
She was allowed to see us once a month.
And were you angry with her for putting you there?
No, no, fortuitously, that kind of anger or angst never occurred to me. I knew she was, even in those early years, I knew she was in terrible straits, and she had no alternative.
Now, you became a shampoo boy when you were 14. You say in the documentary about you that it was your mother's idea for you to become a hairdresser. She had some kind of dream
premonition
that you should be a hairdresser.
Absolutely.
How old were you, and how did she say to you, I've had this dream, son, you should be a hairdresser?
I looked at her in horror. My response was, no, never. Well, what do you want to do? I don't know, but at 14, to become a hairdresser.
Why was that horrifying to you at the age of 14?
It just wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to play soccer, and I won the school championship in running, and I was into all that kind of thing where sport was concerned. I was useless as a student, absolutely useless. I never could learn anything that I didn't like.
So when she took you to a hairdresser for you to apprentice and you became a shampoo boy at the age of 14, what did you like about it? What changed your mind and made you think, yeah, this is for me?
The pretty girls. It's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many pretty girls coming into the salon as clients and others working in the salon. And I thought, this is rather nice. But I was a very average shampoo boy in the sense I could shampoo, but I mean, I was a very average apprentice. I wasn't any better than anybody else. And the war was on. You slept on your pants in the shelter so that you had a crease the next day. Mr. Cohen, who I worked for, was a great disciplinarian. I think I learned so much from him because of that. You had to have pressed trousers, clean shoes, and clean nails. Now, this was in the middle of a war, and you weren't even at home. You were sleeping in shelters. So sometimes it wasn't quite possible, but we did our best.
So when did you realize you wanted to make this your life?
Well, I was politically involved with the anti-fascist group, 43 group. And that meant that sometimes you got into a little trouble. At the age of 20, I joined the Israeli army. I was in the Palmach, which was one of their great groups, founded by actually Rabin and Ord Wingate and a whole bunch of marvelous people. I spent a year there, came home, had nothing. The only thing I knew what to do was hairdressing, and I was quite bad at that. And then I decided, well, if I'm going to have to be in hair, let me change my attitude. Let me see if I can do something worthwhile. And, things started to happen.
Right. Now, during your career, you've done so many fashion shows. So two of the main things that have had an impact on hair in the past few decades are fashion shows and music. Especially starting with the Beatles, whose haircuts, ended up like changing so many people's hair.
Yeah.
So when you first saw the Beatles' haircut, what did you think of it?
Great. Because in a funny way, their whole front was very much like a five-point cut.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. You know, that fringe, that bang that came all the way down to the sides was very much like the five-point cut. I should have sent them a letter of thanks, actually.
So you thought of it as like the male version of the Sassoon in a way?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. No question, yes.
And hippie hair, when hippie started, like in the late 60s, when a lot of men and women, young men and women, started wearing their hair long, messy, not going to professionals to get it cut or styled, what'd you think?
I think they should be charged and given 6 months. It was a dreadful time. And even today, when I see these long-hanging locks at the sides, that have him in shaped well. Long hair's beautiful when it's cut long, but when it's just left hanging and straggly, I think, do these people have style? I mean, their clothes look well, but where's their bone structure? You can't see a thing. All you can see are curtains.
Curtains being the hair that's covering the face.
Yeah.
So one last question. You have a nice head of hair. You're in your 80s and you still have a really full head of hair, right?
Getting a little thin on top, darling.
Okay. If you had lost your hair at a young age, would that have had a bad effect on you? Did you ever worry about that? Would you have cared?
Oh, I think it would have had a terrible effect. I mean, there's this guy talking about marvelous hair, and he's got none. No, I don't think it would have worked at all. I'm very lucky to keep my hair.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, Dad. Thank you so much.
The new documentary, Vidal Sassoon, opens in New York this week and will open in other cities in the coming weeks. You can see a slideshow of Sassoon's haircuts on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.